It's chapter number 16. As we continue our way through the book of Genesis, this is message number 17, entitled The Son of the Servant. We'll be looking at this chapter, and we'll start with verse number 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. Well, chapter 15 that we studied last time brought up the crucial obstacle to the promises to Abraham being fulfilled, and that is the fact that Abraham was childless. You see, central to the covenant that God made with Abraham was the promise of a seed, the promise of a male child who would inherit the promises of Abraham that would extend on to an untold number of generations after him. Now, Abraham was nearing 80 years old, and we don't know how long he and Sarah had been married. We don't have any way of knowing that. But they'd obviously been together a long time. They'd been together a long time without children. And Abraham in chapter 15, he questions God about this, and God confirms his promises to him. Abraham is essentially saying, you know, you've made these promises. I'm still childless. I don't see how this is going to work. God further confirms to Abraham, though, in Genesis 15, in this vision, where he ratifies his covenant with Abraham by passing between the animal pieces while Abraham is in a trance-like state. Now, God prophesied to Abraham that he would himself have a son and that he would go on to live to a good old age. So chapter 15 continued this theme of the testing of faith that we have seen developing over the last few chapters after the calling of Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. And this testing of faith is shown as there's various obstacles and problems in the way. Sometimes people, sometimes Abraham himself, whatever the case may be, but there's these problems that seem to have to be overcome in order for these promises to be fulfilled. And so this also emphasizes, in chapter 15, it also emphasizes this central concern of the promised seed, which will continue for a few chapters here in Genesis until Isaac, in fact, is born to Abraham and Sarah. So the chapter previous to this one also contributes to the progressing revelation of what's at stake in God's promises to Abraham. In other words, it becomes clearer that God's own name is on the line in fulfilling the promises that he made to Abraham as he goes through this ratification of the covenant with Abraham. And we also have this mention of generations and all these different nations in chapter 15, revealing the scope of these promises as truly extending far beyond Abraham himself and just his own family. So as we come to chapter 16, we once again get a heightening of the difficulties. The trouble and the obstacles can continue to mount. And so time has continued to pass on by. And Abraham and Sarah, as the old saying goes, aren't getting any younger. Every day that passes seems to make these promises more and more difficult, if not impossible, to be fulfilled. So Abraham and Sarah are in what may be one of the most trying situations that we experience as people and as followers of Christ. They're having to wait. They're having to wait on a promise that seems to be more impossible every day that passes them by. So this chapter, chapter 16, it turns on conflicts. And conflicts actually are not resolved, at least not until much later, and this tells us that what we have here is an attempted solution that doesn't work. It has failed. So as we look at this chapter, we're going to divide it into two parts, verses 1 to 6 where we see Sarah exercising the handmaid option, and in verses 7 to 16, where we actually encounter the angel of the Lord. So starting in verses 1 to 6, let's read verses 1 to 3. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. So following right after this ratification of the covenant that we get in Genesis chapter 15, and one remark that probably needs to be made about that was that ratification, that vision, that trance, and the passing between the pieces, that wasn't necessary in order for God to keep his word. In other words, oftentimes today, we have contracts and we, you know, we sign our name and we give various pledges and we do a lot of things that sort of legally bind us and require us to fulfill them, or otherwise we will be under severe penalty. And probably no doubt there are many cases in which if men didn't have such binding contracts, they would not do what it was they were supposed to do. But God is not under more obligation because of this ratification of the covenant. Rather, he's giving this essentially as a sign to Abraham. Abraham's asking, you know, what's going to be given because he hasn't had a child. And so God is still going to fulfill his promises. And this ratification, again, merely gives this sort of a double confirmation, if you will, to Abraham. So God gave this assurance that this promised seed would indeed be Abraham's biological son. And so the account now returns to Sarah. And we haven't really talked a lot of or seen a lot about Sarah so far in the Abraham part of the book of Genesis. But the fact of her barrenness is what we come back to, the very first verse. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, bare him no children. And she will go on to talk about this again in these verses. So this chapter opens up by informing us that Sarah had, in fact, a handmaid, a servant, a woman's servant, who was named Hagar, and she was an Egyptian. Now, we're not told how she came to be Sarah's servant. We don't know. Possibly this was part of when they had gone down into Egypt several years earlier because of the famine in the land of Canaan, but we don't know for sure how all those circumstances came to be, and whatever they were, these are the circumstances. She has this Egyptian woman that is a handmaid, that is a servant to her. Now, as we read this account, and I would say probably most of us here are familiar with this account and familiar with what happens, and as we read this account, as modern readers today, this chapter obviously reads very scandalously. And we need to understand it in its ancient context without condoning the choices. In other words, I'm not saying this makes what took place right. I'm just saying we have to understand in that ancient context what it was actually that took place. So we start with Sarah. Now, Sarah was advanced in age, and she was barren, so she had no children. She'd been married to Abraham for a long time. And again, we don't know how long, exact age of Sarah at this point, and all those kind of things. A lot of things there that we don't know, but from the account, we can tell. I mean, Abraham and Sarah are getting advanced in age and have been married and have had no children. Now, in those times, in those ancient times, barrenness particularly was seen as a curse. And it was usually interpreted as a sign of punishment or of some sort of divine displeasure. I mean, even thousands of years later, when the disciples encountered a man that had been blind from his birth, they immediately asked Jesus, was his blindness the result of his sin or was it his parents' sin? That's in John chapter 9. And verse number 2. In other words, they're default thought was that this sort of a condition is the result of sin. It's some sort of a punishment. It's some sort of a disfavor. And that is the way that barrenness for much of the ancient times in the world was looked upon. It was looked upon as a curse and some sort of a disfavor to the woman. And a barren woman then was one who bore a certain social stigma. I mean, she may have otherwise been married and an upstanding woman, but yet she bore this sort of a social stigma that she had not had any children and in fact could not have any children. But it was even worse than just a social stigma, because among those cultures, it wasn't unusual for a man to even divorce a woman who was barren. If she had provided no children, it wasn't uncommon in much of the ancient world for that woman to become divorced. And of course, upon being divorced, then she would have at least the benefit of the dowry, some subsistence to live on. But a woman in that condition was certainly left vulnerable and oftentimes destitute, because children were also they were the inheritors of the family, but they were also the providers and the caregivers for the parents in their old age. There wasn't Social Security and a lot of those kinds of things. Now, if you think about it, in the book of Ruth, Naomi there was one that suffered the death of her husband and then the deaths of her two sons who had had no children. So she had no children. Now she doesn't have a husband. She has no children. She doesn't have any grandchildren. She doesn't have any more family in that sense. So she's left essentially in her old age and in poverty, making her situation doubly bitter. And that's exactly what she says about it in that book. All right, so for a woman in Sarah's situation, it wasn't unusual, and in fact, it was certainly seen as custom, as even acceptable, that she would give her handmaid or her female servant to act as a surrogate mother so that she could have a child by proxy. And you see Sarah even saying that I may have a child by her or obtain children by her, she says in verse number 2. Now, obviously, in those such times, they didn't have the medical fertility treatments and things that we do today, and sometimes they still can't overcome barrenness, but in a lot of cases, there's various things that can be done and can be helped. But certainly, that was no option that was available to her at that time. And a son that would be born to her female servant under these situations, acting as a surrogate mother, would then be counted fully as her son and would be the heir and so on. So in other words, the choice that Sarah's making here is a choice that wasn't unusual. It wasn't something that was out of the norm. It wasn't like when Paul rebuked the Corinthian church, talking about things that weren't even named among the Gentiles, that it wasn't even acceptable in the society, as corrupt as it was, that was going on there. This is not that kind of a situation. So her choice was a socially acceptable choice, and another factor also could have contributed to her decision. You see, one other option for a childless wife and husband would be to adopt. They could adopt a child as their own. But this option was ruled out in the previous chapter's encounter, where God specified that the promised seed would be born of Abraham's own body. He could not name Eleazar, his head servant, to be his heir. He couldn't, in that sense, adopt him as his own son. So Sarah was in the position that we all come to at one time or another. She's desperate. She's out of options. She just doesn't have a lot of choices. And so she makes this choice pertaining to her handmaid. Now, we're introduced here to Hagar, And it's emphasized here and throughout this account, actually, that Hagar was from Egypt. We read that over and over again. So obviously this looks back to their sojourn in Egypt. It's foreshadowing the bondage in Egypt to come, the links there, and also giving us a subtle foreshadowing of the conflict to come. Now, Sarah states that the Lord had held her back, that it's translated here, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing in verse number 2. And so the word that she's using essentially, it restrained, being held back, being prevented in some way. Sarah is saying that the Lord has not allowed me to have children. And so then she offers Hagar to Abraham. Now, Moses here makes a note in verse number 3 that Abraham had been in the land of Canaan for 10 years. And I believe this puts him around 85 years old at the time that this happens here in chapter number 16. Now the next verse is verses 4 to 6. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. So this account presents Hagar's conception as happening rather quickly. And the result of that was that Hagar then in turn despised Sarah. And that seems to have been something of an unexpected result. And we're not told how that manifested. We're not told that how her despising of Sarah came about. That we don't know. But obviously Sarah is aware of it and certainly takes exception to it. And so she goes to Abraham, complaining to him, and she's seeking a judgment. In other words, she's sort of putting it in his hands to make a decision to do something about this, and he refers the case back to her. And then we're told that she dealt hardly with her, a word that means she afflicted her. And again, we're not told how that all manifested, what all that looked like. We don't know. But she deals with her in this way to the point that Hagar fled away. And from what we read, she obviously leaves. She's by herself. She is with child at this point. She's by herself, and she's fleeing away. And from what we see in the next part of the chapter, she's obviously trying to find her way back home. Now, here and later, as we read this account, you're going to pick up on these little subtle references, subtle allusions, all the way back to chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, where God said that he was going to bless those that blessed Abraham, and he was going to curse those that cursed Abraham. And so here we see a subtle allusion to that promise in this blessing and cursing, because first of all, Hagar cursed Sarah, and these words continue to recur. Hagar cursed Sarah, and so Sarah cursed her. And now Hagar has fled and is separating herself from Abraham and Sarah. Now we get to the second part of the chapter, where we are introduced to the angel of the Lord. Look at verse number 7. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. So Hagar was by this well on the way to Shur, as it mentions, and this means she was on her way back to Egypt. This would be en route from the Hebron area where Abraham was on the way back to Egypt. Now, this is the first mention in Genesis that we have of the angel of the Lord that we get here in verse number 7. There will be several appearances in the rest of the book of Genesis, but this is the first one we encounter here in this book. And throughout the Old Testament, there are at least 6 different designations, names, titles, or references for this person, this being that is here called the angel of the Lord. Obviously, the angel of the Lord being one, and you notice Lord, and that's Lord in all caps, and that means that that is Yahweh in the Hebrew that underlies that, the angel of Yahweh. There's also the angel of God that occurs in Genesis chapter 21 and verse 17. There's also his angel, referring to God's angel, Genesis chapter 24, verses 7 and 40. There's also a reference to my angel when God is speaking, Exodus 23, verse 23. There's also what is referred to as the angel of his presence in Isaiah chapter 63 and verse number 9, and the messenger or angel of the covenant, Malachi chapter 3 and verse number 1. So as you read through the Old Testament and you get these references, we can pick up on at least these six different ways in which this same messenger, this same angel is being referred to. Now the word for angel that is used here, it is a word that means a messenger. It means one who is sent. And it can refer to human messengers, and it oftentimes does. It can also refer to supernatural messengers and those beings, those spirit beings that we more often think of as angels. In other words, angel is more of a title. It's more of a description. And so the word occurs in the Old Testament a little over 200 times. It's very, very frequent in the Old Testament. But nearly, almost 100 of those are actually references to the angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord is referred to in 16 of the Old Testament books, and I think those occur mostly in the historical books. So if we stay just in Genesis, we can clearly see some attributes of the angel of the Lord. So even here where we are in chapter 16, the angel of the Lord is presented as being equal or equated to the Lord, equated to Yahweh himself. And we see that in verses 11 to 13. We see it again in Genesis chapter 22, verses 9 to 18, chapter 32, verses 34 to 30, chapter 48, verses 15 to 16. So we see them being equated in essence, but the interesting thing is as you study these references to the angel of the Lord, you can also clearly see them being referred to as distinct. In other words, Yahweh is sending the angel of the Lord. And in some instances, you even have interaction where the angel of the Lord speaks to Yahweh or something of that nature. And also, in Genesis chapter 48 and verse number 16, we see the angel of the Lord forgiving sin. Now, there's more that we can learn about the angel of the Lord in the rest of the Old Testament, but trying to identify this angel of the Lord has actually varied quite a bit throughout history. Some have suggested that this is just Michael the archangel. Some have suggested this is some other specially created angel. Others have suggested a lot of other things. But really, when we study it, when we compare it as we go from Old to New Testament, the angel of the Lord is given divine attributes. The angel of the Lord is given aspects of deity, which is not ascribed to any other angel that you're going to read about in the Bible. And so I do believe that this is the pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. And we do have a number of those that occur in the Old Testament. So this is the Lord that has appeared to her. In his pre-incarnate form, appearing most likely as an angel that looks like a human man, as what we read about. In fact, we read of similar a little later in Genesis. All right, so now let's get to this particular interaction. Look at verses 8 to 12. And he said, that's the angel of the Lord, "Hagar, Sarah's maid, whence comest thou, and whither wilt thou go?" And she said, "I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, "Return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, "I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So the angel, first of all, commands Hagar to return to Sarah and to, in fact, submit to her. So what we get here is actually a subtle reversal of what we saw previously. Previously, she cursed Sarah, and she ended up being cursed by Sarah for cursing Sarah. And so now she is to bless Sarah. She's to return and to submit to her, and she will be blessed by doing that. So again, we get this subtle reference to how these blessings and cursings are going to be administered through the channel of Abraham and in association to him. So we read the blessing through this connection with Abraham. She is bearing Abraham's son. And so God had promised to Abraham that he would have many, many descendants besides just the one seed of promise and besides just that one nation that was going to come through that seed of promise. He's going to have many, many descendants. He's going to have many nations that are going to come from him, many kings that are going to come from him. And so we could see this as a part of this blessing coming through Abraham and going on to Ishmael, which would be many nations descended from him as well. So also we get this prophecy that he'll be a wild man, his hand against every man. Essentially, he's going to be one sort of dwelling on the outskirts, if you will, and not be within that blessed and promised nation that would come from Abraham. Now, the rest of the chapter here, verses 13 to 15. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, Thou God seest me. For she said, Have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Be'er Lahai Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. So she responds, she names the angel of the Lord. Essentially, this name it would be the one who lives and sees me, essentially is what she's saying. And Hagar's son was born. He was named Ishmael, as the Lord said that he was to be. And Moses also notes at this point that Abraham was 86 years old when his son Ishmael was born. And so it's a little bit of a theme that we'll see continuing, these mentionings of Abraham's age, and obviously that age just keeps advancing, and Abraham continuing to be childless as far as the child of promise is concerned. So as we think about chapter 16, that the fact that Abraham and Sarah's choice here was wrong is obvious. It's obvious from the account. It's obvious from what follows in history, as well as the New Testament commentary that we have on this in Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 to 31. And when you think about it, obviously when we look at this, we realize that these conflicts have arisen and they really have not been resolved. I mean, Hagar is going to return to Sarah and she's going to submit to her. Ishmael is going to be born and he's going to continue for a time. And again, his connection to Abraham is going to result in certain blessings and privileges in his life. But actually, Ishmael is going to be an ongoing problem for Abraham, but not just for Abraham, also for his seed, Isaac and Jacob, and on down to Israel that will descend from him. It's going to be an ongoing problem and conflict. So again, it's not really resolved. So again, it's not the right choice. They've done the wrong thing in what they've done here in Genesis chapter number 16. But having said that, the point of this chapter is not to give us rules for marriage. Like that's not the point of what we are reading here. The point of this chapter is actually faith and the promises of God. And we have to keep in mind, who is the original recipients of Genesis? Well, it's the second generation of Israel on the plains of Moab about to go into a land that is populated by giants. People that are about to go on this conquest for the land of Canaan. Why? Because God told them to, because of these promises that God made to Abraham all the way back here. So it is being demonstrated to them God's faithfulness to his promises. Even when we see the weakness of Abraham and Sarah, which comes out at different times in the narratives, at times they appear to be very strong, and at other times we see their weakness. But despite the fact that they do have these weaknesses, God remains faithful to his promises. And God can do what men cannot do. So obviously faith in the promises of God is the point of what we are reading about. What Abraham and Sarah did was very human in the sense of human weakness and limitation. And again, they had come to a point of desperation. They had come to a point of no options. They couldn't simply adopt and name an heir that would receive these promises and would continue on to the generations that followed. So they seemed to be in a very, very difficult place with every passing day making it more and more impossible. Now, against the backdrop, though, of this failure here, the grace and the faithfulness of God shines bright. He had made promises. He had covenanted himself to fulfill them, even though Abraham and Sarah were not always right. They were not always perfect in their thoughts and their actions. But we read how that Abraham believed God and he was counted righteous through faith. That's back in Genesis 15:6. And that meant that his righteousness did not fade or evaporate away when his faith faltered. So what does this mean for us today, a chapter here like Genesis chapter 16? Well, if you're a believer and you're reading this chapter, obviously this isn't an excuse. This isn't a license for sin. The fact that God remains faithful to his promises, even though we see Abraham and Sarah here doing the wrong thing, making the wrong choice, well, that doesn't give us an excuse for sin. It's God's grace and God's faithfulness that Paul wrote about, saying that nothing can separate us from the love of God. So just as John wrote in his first epistle, 1 John chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, if we say that we have no sin, and John is writing to those who have professed faith in Jesus Christ. He says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth's not in us. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So for believers reading a chapter like Genesis chapter 16, we ought to understand that we're not meant to wallow around in guilt and shame over sin, over failure, but confess and repent. But trusting that God is faithful and just to forgive, to cleanse, to restore fellowship. And obviously God's plans are not thwarted by the fact that Abraham and Sarah were humanly weak in this chapter. Well, if you're not a believer and you listen to this message in this chapter of Genesis, realize that you may be like Sarah in some ways. In other words, you may have some humanly difficult circumstances where the only answers seem to be what the Bible clearly calls sin. You may have made choices you realize that have only brought you trouble and only brought you shame. You may be entangled. You may doubt that God could even save someone like you because of it. Well, you need to listen to the promise of God. Because again, that is the point that we're being given. God is faithful to his promise. So here's the promise of God. Romans chapter 10, verses 9 to 13. That if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus and shalt believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believeth unto righteousness, and With the mouth, confession is made unto salvation. For the Scripture saith, whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. For there's no difference between the Jew and the Greek. For the same Lord over all is rich unto all that call upon him. For whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. That's also a promise of the Lord. That everyone that comes to him, as Jesus said, he will not cast out. He will not refuse. He will not turn away. And so even as you read a chapter like this and you realize that, humanly speaking, so oftentimes we choose a sinful path, maybe because we feel like we have no other options, there's nothing else we can do. Maybe that's just simply the way we want to go, but for whatever reason, we end up in those kind of entangled, conflicted situations, and the promise of God is still that we confess with our mouths, we believe with our hearts, and everyone that calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved.